Okay, good afternoon. This is Richard Klemm. We're coming live today on June 20th, 2015, and we are doing part one of Ethics Refresher 2015. And we have callers on the line today from Minnesota and Wisconsin, and we're also recording the program for future Iowa credit. Fortunately, for the portion of the program we're covering today, the rules in the three states are identical or nearly identical, as far as I can tell. I know the Minnesota and Iowa rules that we're covering today are identical, and I think the my quick perusal of the Missouri rules shows that they're pretty much the same as well. So whatever state you happen to be located in, you'll get a background on this portion of the Minnesota, Iowa, or Missouri rules of professional conduct. And in fact, these rules are the same or nearly the same in most other states as well, because they're adapted or from the ABA model code of professional conduct. So whatever state you're in, the basic material is the same. And what we are doing today, we're starting about a three-hour program of simply plotting through the rules of professional conduct to see what the actual text of the rules has to say. To a certain extent, I tell people taking the program that, well, you're really not going to get very much money's worth out of today's program, because it's very rare that you will encounter a situation where you're facing some difficult ethical dilemma and you need some guidance. It's very rare where you can simply turn to the rule and find the exact answer of what you need to do, because usually the problems that confront us in the day-to-day practice of law are considerably more complex, and you simply can't just look at the rule. So like I say, in that sense, you're not going to get your money's worth from the program. Now, I say that, and I'm always alarmed that people will start clamoring for refunds. So I will tell you that you will get your money's worth in two other ways. First of all, you will get CLE credit for today's program. And especially as we have deadlines looming, surprisingly enough, most people who take my programs are taking them because they need the CLE credit. And today's program will get you CLE credit for listening to this material for the next hour. But the other way, and more importantly, I think the thing that I got when I put this program together is that I realized that I had never actually just sat down and read the rules of professional conduct from cover to cover in a very long time. And in fact, the last time I did sit down and read the rules from cover to cover was back in law school when I was getting ready to take the multi-state professional responsibility bar review exam. So today's program will kind of follow the same format of that review course that you took a long time ago when you were in law school, covering just the black and white text of the rules of professional conduct to see what information is actually in there. And as I put the program together, I did realize that I was getting some value out of the process after all, because even though it's very rare that you will have a difficult ethical problem solved simply by looking at the rule, well, there are a few cases where that will happen, because some of the rules are very absolute. I also realized that it had been a long time since I had read the rules, and, well, there might have been a couple of rules in there that I'd forgotten about along the way. There are some very specific things in there that we have to do, so it's a good idea to be reminded of what those are. And, of course, there have been a few amendments over the years. So it is a good idea to keep up to date on what the actual text of the rules are. So what I'm going to do today and over the next 3 hours is simply plod through those rules and tell you what the actual text of the rules has to say, and hopefully make it as interesting as possible along the way. But we won't be delving in too much to the ethical dilemmas that might face us in the day-to-day practice of law, but instead we'll be looking at what the rules actually have to say. I should point out that on those more common ethical dilemmas that come up, my main advice there is that when those difficult problems do come up, the best advice I can give you when you simply don't know what to do, you don't know what your ethical obligations are, is in many cases seeking the counsel of another attorney can oftentimes be very, very helpful in that regard. Not because that other attorney is any smarter than you are, but sometimes just having a fresh set of eyes look at a problem will really make a difference. Because when you get bogged down in a particular case and you have this particular problem in front of you, oftentimes the problem looks bigger than it really is. And sometimes just the process of asking the question might reveal the answer to you. But getting a fresh look at the problem is often a very helpful thing to do. And in fact, as I've read a lot of ethics opinions from various courts, about 90% of the time, I come to the conclusion, when you read through the fact pattern, if this poor attorney had just gone down the hall and talked to some other attorney in his office or talked to a friend or a colleague, he probably could have avoided this whole big mess that he got himself into, either because sometimes the solution to the problem was so simple, but when you keep plodding along and not seeing that simple solution, that can make it worse. So always seek outside legal counsel if you need it. Now, that doesn't have to be a formal legal opinion from another attorney. Sometimes that's called for, but usually just informally consulting with another attorney can really help you out. One thing to keep in mind, though, is that when you do seek that outside legal advice, make sure it's outside legal advice, because one of the rules we'll probably get to in this portion of the program is the confidentiality rules. Well, you can't just go talking to other people about your ethical problems, because you're probably going to violate your client's confidentiality in doing that. Fortunately, though, there is an exception, and that is when you are seeking advice, when you are seeking legal advice on how to proceed under the rules of professional conduct. That's an exception to confidentiality, but only if the person you're consulting is an attorney. And one sad story from a few years ago here in Minnesota was actually a civil lawsuit where an attorney was he worked as general counsel for a corporation. He was an in-house attorney, and he was facing this ethical dilemma. He had encountered some illegality within his company, and he was wondering what to do. Well, he went to his father and asked for some fatherly advice on how he should proceed. Well, unfortunately, his father wasn't an attorney, and he got fired, and he subsequently filed a whistleblower statute lawsuit because he was fired for exposing illegality. And the Minnesota Supreme Court threw out his case, even though he had gotten a substantial verdict because he fit within the statute, because you could tell the Supreme Court was a little bit nervous about an attorney suing a former client, and they were kind of looking for any reason to throw off the case. And what they seized upon was that he had violated the client confidentiality by seeking that outside advice. Now, if his father had been an attorney, that wouldn't have been a problem for him, but unfortunately he wasn't. So watch out for that. Always seek outside legal advice when you need it, but make sure it's outside legal advice. And then if you want to do any light reading on the subject of legal ethics, you're just so excited after today's program, you want to read more about the subject, the book I would recommend to you is Minnesota Legal Ethics by William Wernz. And it's in the course materials here, there's a link to it. Even though the title of the book is Minnesota Legal Ethics, it's applying the same rules that are in use in Iowa and Missouri and most other states. So it probably gets some helpful information about from that book. But the book has two redeeming features. First of all, the subject of legal ethics is not actually the most interesting subject in the world, believe it or not. But this is about as interesting a book as you can have, yet still cover the subject matter, because Mr. Wernz, the author, was the head of the Minnesota Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility for many years. So the book is actually full of all kinds of interesting stories of his years running that office. So it's worth a look for that reason. It's kind of interesting. And the other redeeming feature of this book is that it's free. You can download it as a free ebook. Link is on the materials here, but it's made available by the Minnesota Bar Association. So if you got a new Kindle or something and you're looking for material to load into it, you can take a look for that. And if you want to ever do more reading on the subject of legal ethics, you can read that book. So anyway, well, with that introduction out of the way, I'm just going to go ahead and start jumping into the materials here. And before I do that, I'm going to give the first code number. For those of you taking this program as a podcast, as an on-demand program, please write down these code numbers, unless you're in traffic. Please write down these numbers, and at the end of the program, you can email them to me with, in some states, with an affidavit, but that shows that you were here. And the first code number for this segment of the program is E518. E as in ethics, 518. E518 is the first code number for this section of the program. So with that, we jump right into the rules, starting with rule 1.0, which we won't belabor too much, because rule 1.0 is simply a list of definitions of other terms used within the rules. And I point that out not because there's anything particularly profound in that section, but quite a few terms are defined, even though they might have a plain English dictionary definition as well. So if you ever do get to one of those rules where you can't quite figure out the meaning of a provision, well, sometimes if you look at the definition of some of the terms, even for terms that you know what they mean, like client and attorney and so forth, that might provide guidance in some situations when you get to some ambiguity. So just keep in mind that a lot of words are defined in Rule 1.0. The only one that I can think of where the definition in that rule maybe differs from what the word really means in everyday language is the definition of the word writing. The definition of the word writing in Rule 1.0 is something to the effect of anything that is preserved in permanent form. So, for example, an audio recording is a writing for purposes of the rules. If you left a voicemail for somebody, that would constitute a writing. So I mean, if you ever get in trouble for not having something in writing, well, if you left a voicemail, well, maybe you could argue that that was a writing. An email is certainly a writing. So so when you need to confirm things in writing, keep that in mind. But also keep in mind that there's some confidentiality issues when it comes to email, so you have to watch out for those as well. There are a lot of definitions there, so if you ever get to a particularly perplexing problem, I'll try looking up the definitions. Maybe that might provide some clarity, or maybe it'll make the problem worse, but be aware that Rule 1.0 is there. Well, the first actual substantive rule, though, is Rule 1.1, and all the rules we're going to be covering in this hour of the program start with a 1, and the rules starting with 1 that actually take up 2.5 hours of the 3-hour program are your relationship with your client, because obviously that's an important subject. Some of the other rules cover other situations, but the bulk of the rules are spent on Rule 1, covering your relationship with your client. And Rule 1.1 is definitely one where you're not going to get any money's worth from the program, because this is one where I'm simply going to read the rule to you. Because Rule 1.1 simply says that you shall provide competent representation to your clients. And unfortunately, it doesn't even define competency very much, other than to, Justice Stewart would say, you'll know it when you see it, but it says that competent representation requires legal knowledge, skill, thoroughness, and preparation that are reasonably necessary for the representation. So so it's that, like I say, I didn't provide you much value. If you already knew you were supposed to be competent, that's what our clients are paying for. But I guess we need the reminder that, in addition, that's one of our ethical obligations, to be competent in our representation. There's a first time for everything, though. If you're a brain surgeon, there's that first time when you have to take the scalpel in hand and do your first brain surgery. Well, the mere fact that you're doing it for the first time does not mean that you're incompetent. But the comment to this rule points out that that can be you might need to acquire that competence. You can't you have to practice on cadavers if you're a surgeon before you you cut into your first brain or whatever that equivalent is for us attorneys. But we do have to be competent, and you have to. Have a reasonable level of that competence. So that's the first rule where you don't, which you already knew. Rule 1.2 follows that, and I guess I would say that rule 1.2 is probably the most important rule of all the rules that we're going to cover during the program, because it kind of defines what our position is. It kind of defines what our responsibilities are. And it's also referred back to by many other rules as kind of the test of whether or not we've met our obligation under some other rule. So we will spend a little bit more time on Rule 1.2. It's also a very simple rule, and it's written in very absolute terms. And it simply says that we must always abide by our client's decisions, period. It's a little bit more verbose than that. But that's basically what it says. It's a very absolute rule. It says you always have to abide by your client's decisions. I think the rule actually says in connection with the objectives of the representation or something. But it's a very absolute rule that says your client is always right. Now, there are some exceptions to it, and we'll talk about those exceptions, some right now and some as we go on in the program. But there are not many exceptions, and there are not maybe some exceptions that we would think of as being common sense. So, for example, it seems kind of like common sense if your client wants to do something really stupid or something very contrary to their own interests or something extremely foolish. Well, common sense would kind of say, well, there's an exception to that. We shouldn't abide by our client's decision if our client wants to do something extremely foolish. But unfortunately, that exception is not written into the rule. There is no rule that says you shall abide by your client's decisions as long as your client is being smart about it. No, it says you shall abide by your client's decisions always, even if your client wants to make a stupid decision. Now, later in another part of the program, when we get to, for example, a client with a diminished capacity or something, well, then there might be an exception in that case. But the general rule is no. If your client wants to do something foolish, well, you have to go along with the client. Now, because you're a competent attorney, because of Rule 1.1, well, then you should you probably have an obligation to try to talk your client out of it. But ultimately, if your client just won't listen to reason, you still have to abide by that client's decision. Now, if it gets extreme, you might want to quit. And in another rule, we'll talk about the situations where you are permitted to quit, which is actually pretty wide open in most cases. But as long as you are continuing to represent the client, well, you have to abide by their decisions. And like I say, there are some exceptions we'll talk about in a little while. Well, we have these clients running around doing all these foolish things and hiring us to do them. So the rule goes on to say that all these decisions are the clients. Therefore, what our actions, the things we do, the fact that we continue working on the case, does not constitute an endorsement of our client's political, economic, social, or moral views or activities. So in other words, it's making clear that, no, it is the client's decision. If the client wants to do something that's repugnant, that doesn't mean that we're endorsing what they're doing. We are simply following this rule, saying that all those decisions are indeed belong to the client. So, for example, that's why, you know, sometimes your non-lawyer friends will, they want to sound intellectual, so they'll ask you, well, would you represent a guilty person? And they think that's a big ethical dilemma or something. And, you know, so I always answer, well, of course I would, because the guilty person needs the attorney more than the innocent person does. Well, the reason I can say that, the reason I can represent criminals, I don't really very much, but if I wanted to, the reason I can represent criminals is not because I'm endorsing their criminality. No, the decision of whether they're going to plead guilty or not guilty, whether they want to go to trial, well, that's certainly the client's decision, and I have to abide by their decision, whether I agree with them or not. So we always have to abide by our client's decisions. The first exception comes right away. Well, what if our client wants to do something illegal? That's an exception because you have to abide by your client's decisions, but you can't assist in conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. Well, that's pretty easy. You know, your client walks in and, you know, you're not going to do this. Your client comes in and says, well, you know, I have this forged document, and I want you to, you know, go record it for me or whatever. Well, of course you can't do that because you're assisting with conduct that you know is criminal or fraudulent. So that's pretty easy. But the where it gets a little bit more difficult is the exception to the exception. You're not allowed to assist with criminality, but what you are allowed to do is discuss the legal consequences of your client's proposed course of conduct so that they can make a good faith determination of the scope, meaning, or application of the law. So, in other words, and I used to joke around and say that this had really happened to me, then I realized I had put a bunch of attorneys on the NSA watch list. So I'll point out that the following is a hypothetical. This did not actually happen. But in this hypothetical, I had a client in Hawaii. And he worked for the government. And he called me up one day, and he told me that he was planning on going on vacation to Hong Kong. Yeah, that's normally a normal thing to do. But it turns out part of his contract with his employer said that he was not allowed to leave the country without telling his boss. In fact, it was a serious criminal offense for him to leave the country without telling his boss. Anyway, he called me up and he asked me to research the extradition treaty with Hong Kong. So I went to the library, I looked up the extradition treaty, and I told him that things are kind of delayed over in Hong Kong, and you know the U.S. government has to you know fill out every paper just perfectly, otherwise the authorities there would ignore the request, and he would be able to. Travel to a third country if he so chose. So I gave him that information. Well, lo and behold, he acted on my advice. He flew to Hong Kong in violation of his employment contract. It was just a huge controversy over it. He finally wound up in Russia. So the question is, well, did I violate this rule? Did I assist him in conduct that I knew was criminal or fraudulent? Because in this hypothetical case, I should remind everybody, I knew that he was planning on doing something criminal. So, in fact, I probably even told him, well, you know, that's a serious crime. You better not do that. But I did give him the information. So was I assisting in conduct that I knew was criminal or fraudulent? Well, I don't think so. I think I'm okay. Now, maybe the U.S. attorney might think differently here, so I... If you're doing that, you might want to be careful. Maybe do a little bit more research than this one CLE. But I think there I'm in pretty good shape because all I was doing was discussing the legal consequences of his proposed course of conduct. And it was up to him to make that decision because, after all, I shall abide by my client's decision. And I can't, you know, throw myself in front of the airplane that's taking off. That was ultimately his decision. So I think I'm okay there because I was simply providing that information. Now, if I had given him a ride to the airport, well, then I'd probably be in big trouble because not only would I be violating this rule, but that would probably be turned into some kind of a criminal offense because I was actually actively assisting him in his violation of the law. But I think in that hypothetical, just providing that information is okay. This rule concludes by saying that I can limit the scope of the representation. So in other words, if somebody comes into my office and has two legal needs, I can limit the representation to just one of those things. But there has to be disclosure. It has to be reasonable, and the client has to consent to that. Now, one interesting issue that comes up that we don't have a specific rule in Minnesota, Iowa, or Missouri, but it's an issue that's come up for me occasionally. Well, what if the client wants to limit the scope of representation to simply having me draft some documents that he's going to file with the court? Well, I think that's reasonable, but there are a few kind of sticky things that go along with that because first of all, am I kind of concealing my involvement in the case? So, for example, my client is getting sued, and, you know, it's not the kind of case I participate in, you know, he has to find an attorney within 20 days and file the answer, and today is day 19. So I just draft a pro se answer for him and give it to him and say, well, take this down to the courthouse, file it, whatever. So can I limit the scope of my representation that way? It raises some issues because, first of all, well, am I kind of concealing the fact that I was involved in the case? Am I subject to Rule 11 violations for drawing up that piece of paper? A lot of questions like that. If a third party is involved and some third party is giving him advice who's not an attorney, well, am I assisting in the unauthorized practice of law by doing that? So it is the kind of thing I've done occasionally, but it does raise some of those issues. The reason I bring it up here is because Nebraska has in their version of the rules, they have kind of a safe harbor provision, you know, where they specifically say that is okay, that is an acceptable thing for Nebraska attorneys to do, to avail yourself of the protection of that rule. In Nebraska, the document has to say that it has to have your name and address, and it has to say that the documents were drafted by you. Just like in Minnesota, for example, if I draft a deed down at the bottom, it says, you know, this document drafted by, and I have my name and address. Well, in Nebraska, it extends that practice to filing documents for pro se litigants. So it's probably a good idea to do, even if you're in some other state. But just be aware, if you ever are in one of those situations where a client wants you to draft documents for pro se use, keep in mind that there are some issues surrounding that that you should give some thought to. And if you're in Nebraska, it's a little bit easier because they have kind of a safe harbor provision. But in other states, you might have to give it a little bit more thought. So anyway, like I say, of all the rules, I think Rule 1.2 is the most important because it kind of defines our relationship and it's referred back to in a lot of the other rules. Moving on to Rule 1.3, and I know, Minnesota attorneys always get nervous when I bring this up, approaching June 30th, because it says Rule 1.3 says you're not supposed to procrastinate. And sure enough, in fact, my conference call is in 10 days on June 30th. I will have people getting them on that very last day. In fact, I'll have even more on August 31st, which is kind of the drop-dead deadline, because there are a lot of procrastinating attorneys in the state, and they always get nervous when I tell them about this rule, but I always tell them not to worry, because Rule 1.3 says you shall act with reasonable diligence and promptness in representing a client. So it is okay to procrastinate on your CLEs as long as you get them done by the deadline. But in fact, the reason why you're those attorneys on June 30th procrastinated is because they were so busy representing their clients. But don't procrastinate when it comes to representation of a client, because first of all, it's a violation of this rule. But also, that prompts complaints about other things, because the client thinks you're not doing things fast enough. So eventually, because you're not returning their calls, so they try to figure out they want to find somebody else to call, and they find the number where they can call to make an ethics complaint. So you don't want them finding that number, and the best way to do that is by not procrastinating, especially when it comes to Rule 1.4. What should you be really careful not to procrastinate about? Rule 1.4, communications. You should always communicate. Now, many of these rules that we're covering today, sometimes you have to give a lot of thought to what exactly you're supposed to do. Because in many cases, in most cases, you cannot err on the side of caution. It's always nice to err on the side of caution. You know, the speed limit is 60 miles an hour, so you're going to err on the side of caution and drive 59 miles an hour. Well, if you're on the freeway and you err on the side of caution and you're driving 30 miles an hour, well, you're below the minimum speed limit. So you can't just err on the side of caution. But fortunately, Rule 1.4 is one rule where you are allowed to err on the side of caution, because you might get into trouble for under-communicating, but it would be, I can't really think of any situations where you would get into trouble for over-communicating. So always err on the side of caution and communicate everything to your client. But you don't have to communicate everything. In fact, one attorney pointed out to me maybe there's not any side of caution here either, because this attorney, she was explaining she used to send out a copy of everything. The most insignificant little thing that happened, she would mail it to the client. She was discovering that her clients weren't even opening the mail that came from her. So she noticed some client had, at the conclusion of the case, had this big stack of unopened envelopes from her, because they get nervous, they get stressed out when they get something. Maybe they think that you're overcharging because you're sending out all these extraneous scraps of paper. So maybe there is a time when you should not over-communicate, but you probably won't get into trouble for violating the rules simply by over-communicating. So always err on the side of caution, I think, is still my main advice here. But the rule does specify a certain number of situations where you are required to communicate. So you will definitely get in trouble if you don't communicate in any of these situations. And some of these are very general. Kind of your general obligation to communicate is not particularly burdensome. You have to tell the client how their objectives are going to be carried out. You have to let them know about the status of the case. And you have to comply with any reasonable request for information. So it's written in pretty general terms. So it's not particularly onerous. That's kind of your general obligation. You have two specific times when this rule says that you have to communicate. First of all, any time the client has to consent to something, well, obviously you can't have consent without communication. You know, the client has to say, yes, I consent. If it's informed consent, you have to show that you communicated the information to them. Also, you have to let the client know about any relevant limitations on your conduct. So, for example, if... this case could be filed in Minnesota or Missouri because it's some kind of interstate thing, and we could file it in Minnesota court or we could file it in Missouri court. You're only admitted in one of those two states. If that's relevant, then you might have to explain to your client, I can file it in this state, but I'm not authorized to file it in the other state. So therefore, that's a limitation on my conduct. Or if it's a limitation based on the rules, such as maybe a conflict of interest or something like that. The like I say, you can err on the side of caution on Rule 1.4, but the kind of the acid test of whether or not you've met your obligation is whether or not you've communicated sufficient information so that the client can intelligently participate in decisions. Because as you recall, the Rule 1.2 says that the client has to make all decisions. So the test of whether or not you've communicated is, did I communicate enough information so the client can participate in those decisions? So, you know, the fact that you got a settlement offer, well, the client can't intelligently participate in that unless you tell them about the offer. You would certainly be required to communicate that. We're rescheduling the, deposition of the expert witness that you're not going to attend anyway. That's probably information that does not need to be communicated to the client because that doesn't affect their ability to participate in decisions. But again, you will not get into trouble if you do communicate that to them. So again, I guess I would err on the side of caution. So Rule 1.4 covers communications, Rule 1.3 says don't procrastinate when it comes to communications, because bad news doesn't get any better when you just sit on it. So make sure you communicate with your clients promptly, and that will avoid so many problems, because, like I say, when you start going incommunicado, that's when they start getting nervous and start doing things like filing complaints and whatever. So Rule 1.5 covers the subject of fees, and the rule itself goes into a little bit more detail in some things. So we're going to gloss over it just a little bit, because the main part of Rule 1.5 simply says that fees cannot be unreasonable. So you can't charge an unreasonable fee to a client, but it doesn't define what a reasonable fee is. But it lists a bunch of factors on whether or not your fee is reasonable. The amount of time required, obviously the case that took 2 hours, you're going to charge more than the case that took 1 hour. The novelty and difficulty, so if you have a consumer bankruptcy and you charge them $1 million, well, that's probably unreasonable. But if the city of Detroit walks into your office and wants to file bankruptcy and you charge them $1 million, well, that's probably okay because that's more novel and difficult. Whether the case will prevent you from taking on other employment, the customary charge in your locality does not mean you have to match prices with other attorneys, but, if everybody else in town is charging $1,000 for this kind of transaction and you're charging $10,000, well, then maybe you're unreasonable. The amount involved in the results obtained is relevant. Time limitation, nature and length of the relationship with the client. So your long-time sophisticated client, you can probably get away with charging a higher fee than your brand-new, unsophisticated client. Your experience and reputation. So everybody, both of you, can charge more because of that. And finally, whether or not your fee is fixed or contingent. And we'll talk about contingent fees in a minute. And those aren't exclusive, but it's just some factors to be kept in mind. Now, the if I've ever violated a rule, it's probably the next rule. I don't think I have, but this is a rule that's easy to violate. So maybe you'll get your money's worth just out of this, being reminded of this. The fee and the scope of representation shall be communicated in writing. Now, I don't know if this was an amendment recently, but most of the states adopting this rule have the word preferably in there, which is maybe has saved me from a potential violation of this. Because how could somebody violate this rule? Well, you violate this rule by being a nice guy. So my phone rings and my client wants me to do something, and so I just quote them a price over the phone. They call up and say, oh, I need you to draft a quit claim deed. How much does that cost? And I say, oh, that's no problem. I'll do that for you for $100. And I already have all the information here. I will just go ahead and do it. I'll mail it to you. I'll send you a bill after I'm finished. Well, that sounds like a reasonable fee to me. And so the client agrees and he says, well, that's great. You go ahead and get to work on it. So I just sit down and I get to work on it. I prepare the deed. I mail it to them along with a bill of $100. Well, maybe I violated this rule because I communicated that fee information to them, but I did not do it in writing. I communicated it to them over the phone. So there, I guess the if I ever got in trouble for that, I guess what I would make two arguments. I would say, well, I didn't violate because it says preferably in writing. So it's maybe not an absolute rule, but you know, then they're going to ask me, well, why did you not do the preferable thing? So I don't know if I would want to hang my hat on that. And I guess the other argument I would make would say, well, I did communicate it in writing because after I was done, I sent them a written bill. Well, I don't know if that would float either. I think it kind of implies that you communicated before they incur the fee. So watch out for that. It's a good idea to follow up those phone calls with some kind of a writing. It doesn't have to be formal. It doesn't have to be signed by anybody, but it does have to be in writing. So an email, you know, is a writing. So that would work. You know, subject, you know, some confidentiality issues maybe. But the moral of that story is follow those things up with writing. Now in Wisconsin, I would be okay. I wouldn't have to worry quite so much because most of my clients don't have $1,000, so I never worry about charging people more than $1,000. And in Wisconsin, there's kind of a black letter rule saying that if the reasonably foreseeable cost is less than $1,000. Then it's sufficient that it's communicated orally. It does not need to be communicated in writing. So I guess in Wisconsin I'd be a little bit better shape. I guess on the other hand, though, in Wisconsin, if I communicated them $1,001, well, because it is kind of a black and white rule, I guess I wouldn't be in quite as strong ground saying, well, it says preferably, but, you know, it's kind of an absolute number, too. So anyway, it's a good idea to follow up those phone calls with a writing to avoid any problems with this rule. As I mentioned before, contingent fees are allowed. Contingent fees do have to be in writing. They have to be signed by the client. And there are a number of specific requirements that we're not going to cover right now. But if you're doing a contingent fee, make sure that you take a look at Rule 1.5 and make sure the contract covers all of the points that you're required to. And one must have caused a lot of grief over the years, so it's specifically in there, the question of how do you deal with expenses? You know, do you calculate the percentage before or after expenses? That has to be spelled out in detail. So contingent fees are allowed. Now, normally, you know, when I say contingent fee, you think, you know, well, that means, you know, the lawyer gets one-third. And, yes, that's obviously a contingent fee where the attorney gets a percentage of the recovery. But for purposes of this rule, the word contingent fee means any time your fee varies depending upon the outcome of the case. So a percentage of the recovery, obviously your fee varies. But it could be anything. No fee unless we win. Well, that's a contingent fee. Or any time your fee varies. And now, the reason why that's important, because if we don't explain that, the two exceptions here don't make any sense. Because there are two cases where you're not allowed to collect a contingent fee. You're not allowed to collect them in family law cases or in criminal cases. Well, I can't think of many situations there where you would get a percentage of the recovery, or I suppose you could get a percentage of the alimony, and that would be a violation because it's a contingent fee. But any time your fee varies depending upon the result of the case, well, how could you have that in a criminal case? Well, the lawyer gets 10 years, so, you know, or the client gets 30 years, so the lawyer gets 10 years. But you cannot have something like a no fee unless you are acquitted. Because that would be a contingent fee in a criminal case. Now, I don't think many attorneys wouldn't last very long if you started advertising that. But the leading case on the subject of contingent fees in criminal cases comes from Wisconsin, where an attorney was advertising that he was a DWI, drunk driving attorney, and he was advertising that he would win your case or you get a free bicycle. So kind of a neat advertising gimmick. He would go fight for you in court, and he would just win hands down, and life would get back to usual, and you would pay your fee. Or maybe things didn't go quite so well, and you either spent some jail time or you lost your driver's license or something. Well, in those cases, you would get a free bicycle. So your transportation needs would be taken care of one way or another. Either the case would get tossed out and you could resume driving, or at least, you know, you can get around on your new bicycle. Well, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that that was not permitted under this rule because that is a contingent fee in a criminal case. Because in cases he wins, he gets a certain fee. In cases he loses, he gets that fee minus the price of the bicycle. And that was held to be enough to be a contingent fee in a criminal case. So that's not permitted. The final subject covered by Rule 1.5 is fee splitting. Now, be careful when you get to this rule because we are not covering – Rule 1.5 actually doesn't say anything about referral fees. Another rule, Rule 7 point something, says that you cannot get a referral fee for referring a case to another attorney. Referral fees are not permitted. In fact, if you only learn one thing from today's course, remember that. Referral fees are not permitted in Minnesota and Iowa, probably not in Missouri, probably not in most other states. In a few states, they are permitted, but not in Minnesota and Iowa. I say that, and then a lot of attorneys say, well, no, they are permitted if you do this, this, and this. Well, no, they're not, because referral fees simply are not allowed. So if you ever get a referral fee, for heaven's sake, don't call it a referral fee, because referral fees are illegal. Now, there is something similar, a referral fee in disguise that some attorneys maybe get away with. But referral fees are not allowed. What is allowed, obviously, is sharing a fee with another attorney. So if you and I are co-counsel, we are working together on a case. I did half the work. You did half the work. Well, it stands to reason I get half the money, you get half the money. That's certainly reasonable. There's nothing wrong with that. Or maybe I did 10% of the work, but I'm getting 20% of the pay. Well, that's probably still okay. But what is not okay is you paying me for nothing other than sending somebody to your office. Because that is a referral fee, and it is not permitted. But you tell me, well, wait, attorneys do that all the time. Well, yes, they do. And if they're smart about it, they don't use the word referral fee. They say, I'm sharing the fee with you, because Rule 1.5 says it's okay to share fees with another attorney in proportion to the services provided by each lawyer. So I did half the work, I get half the fee. That's not a problem. Now, when I first started giving this program, I just concluded, and then we moved on to Rule 1.6, and we started talking about something else. And when I got back to the office, I got a frantic email from an attorney saying that I had left off some important language. Well, he was right, I did. Because what I left off was, it's also okay to split a fee with another attorney if both of us maintained responsibility for the case. Because these referral fees that we know really are taking place in Minnesota and Iowa are usually based upon that. But you can't get a referral fee. You can only get a fee for providing services in the case or by maintaining responsibility in the case. Well, what does that mean to maintain responsibility? So I have this personal injury person hobble into my office, and I send him down to the big personal injury firm downtown, and lo and behold, 6 months later, I get a check for a percentage of the fee. I didn't do any work, so I just say, well, I was maintaining responsibility. Well, you have to do more than say you were maintaining responsibility. It seems to me that you have to really maintain responsibility. And kind of the definition of whether you're maintaining responsibility is the answer to the question, well, if that other lawyer downtown screws up the case, can I get sued for malpractice? And if you can, with a straight face, answer that question, yes. If that lawyer downtown commits malpractice, I shall be responsible for it. If you can say that, well, then you are okay under Rule 1.5. And even though it looks kind of like a referral fee, it's actually permitted if you are maintaining responsibility for the case. Now, if I was going to do that, I would want to make sure that I was really maintaining responsibility, like, you know, maybe, you know, looking over that other lawyer's shoulder just a little bit to make sure he doesn't really commit malpractice. You know, kind of the bare minimum of this rule is you're okay as long as you can say with a straight face that you're maintaining responsibility. Then it's okay to share the fee. But for heaven's sake, don't call it a referral fee. You know, so when you, because referral fees under Rule 7 point whatever are not permitted. You have to call it, you know, if you're going to, you know, claim the money under this rule, you better make sure that it's denominated in terms of this rule. You know, so saying, you know, I got this fee because I was maintaining responsibility for the case, or because I was providing services in the case. And the test of whether or not your fee is reasonable is, you know, whatever, you know, when the case is over and you get that check, you know, did your client get that much value out of the case? Or because of your participation in the case? And if you can answer that, say, yes, I got this check for $2,000 because I was maintaining responsibility, or I did $2,000 worth of work, well, then you're okay. But if you have to start hemming and hawing and saying, well, you know, maybe the client didn't get $2,000 worth, but that other lawyer got $2,000 worth of services out of me, well, then it's a referral fee, and it's not permitted. Okay, where we'll probably wrap up here with Rule 1.6, where we talk about confidentiality. Before I do that, let me give our next code number. Our next code number, for those of you who are taking the podcast, is E562. E as in ethics, 562. E562 is the next code number. And we move on to Rule 1.6, talking about confidentiality. Now, it's important to keep in mind what we are not talking about here. The subject we are not going to address today is the attorney-client privilege. It's a related concept, obviously, but it's actually quite different because I've actually never dealt, I don't think, with the attorney-client privilege. It's never come up. Because the attorney-client privilege is actually pretty rare. So what the attorney-client privilege is the my client walks in and communicates with me, and he tells me about all this illegal conduct that he's been engaging in, and he's telling me this because I'm his attorney, and he's giving me this information because I need it to represent him. Or maybe he's giving it to me because I'm his doctor. You know, he comes in with this, gunshot wound and says, well, I got this gunshot wound when I was in this gunfight committing illegal activity. Share this information for the purposes of seeking medical treatment. Well, then, a little while later, the grand jury calls me in and they call the doctor in. And we're sitting there in front of the grand jury and the prosecutor says, tell us what your client told you. And at that point, I say, I refuse to answer that question because of the attorney-client privilege. And the doctor who's there says, I refuse to answer that question because of the physician-patient privilege. The prosecutor has to grudgingly go along with that, and he can't throw either of us in jail for contempt or anything like that. So that's what the attorney-client privilege is. Well, I don't know about you, but that's never happened to me. It's just never come up. It doesn't happen very often. And in fact, there are many exceptions to the attorney-client privilege. It just never comes up. So we really don't worry too much about the attorney-client privilege because it never comes up. You don't have to worry about it. But the confidentiality being talked about here comes up all the time because the attorney-client privilege, for it to kick in, there are certain specific requirements. It can be lost. There are exceptions. But the attorney-client privilege is kind of the exact opposite. It applies all of the time. And it's not talking about whether or not I have to tell the grand jury. It's talking about whether or not I am permitted to talk about my client's case with anyone for any reason. And Rule 1.6, unlike the attorney-client privilege, which is very rare, Rule 1.6 says this is what you and I as attorneys deal with every day. Because it says we must never reveal any information about a representation of a client unless it fits in one of these specific exceptions. So in other words, everything that takes place in your office from 9 until 5, everything is confidential, everything relating to a client in any way, unless you can fit it into one of these exceptions. So in other words, unlike the attorney-client privilege, where you have to, show that, it specifically fits these elements, the confidentiality here, in other words, stuff that you can get in trouble for if you reveal that confidential information, here everything is confidential unless you can point to a specific exception. It's an absolute confidentiality unless it fits in an exception. And there are obviously a number of exceptions because we have to talk about clients all the time. But any time that you do reveal information about a client, you better be able to make sure that you fit it into one of these because, the burden of proof is going to be on you to show that it fits in one of these exceptions. Well, what are those exceptions? You can't reveal anything about a client unless, if the client consents, obviously, he can consent to just about anything. Or disclosures that are impliedly authorized in order to carry out the representation. So in other words, you have to show, you revealed this information, you have to show that there was a need to do it. You were not just gossiping about your client. You had to tell the other insurance company that you're filing a claim. Or you had to tell the judge what happened. Or you had to tell the jury. Or you had to deposit the check that the client gave you. It has to be necessary. To the representation, or unless it fits within some other exception, and there's some other exceptions. In fact, one of those exceptions is stated right here, and I guess it's what we will kind of wind up with. One of those interesting things that fortunately doesn't come up too often in the day-to-day practice of law, but it's kind of an interesting thing to talk about, and that is. Your client tells you they're going to commit a crime. So your client walks in and says, by the way, I'm going to go commit a murder. And they told you that in connection with the representation. Well, what are you supposed to do about that? They're not asking you to assist in the murder. They just shared that piece of information with you. What are you supposed to do with that? Well, there it depends on what state you're located in. So I guess this is one area where there is a difference between the different state rules, and I don't know right offhand what the Missouri rule is, but it'll be similar to one of these that we're going to cover. I'm going to start with Nebraska, even though I don't think we have any Nebraska attorneys taking the program right now. But there are different approaches, and we're going to start with the Nebraska approach because it's kind of a continuum. Well, Nebraska... You're sitting in your Omaha office, and your client tells you they're going to commit a crime. So you get out the rule, and it says that you, as a Nebraska attorney, may reveal information if the lawyer believes it's necessary to prevent the client from committing a crime or fraudulent act that will result in death or serious bodily harm or substantial financial or property damage. So, murder certainly qualifies there. So even though that information is confidential, there's an exception. You as a Nebraska attorney are permitted to reveal that information if you think doing so can prevent the crime from taking place. So you pick up your phone, you call the Omaha Police Department and tell them that your client is about to commit a murder. They go down there, they arrest your client, thereby preventing the murder from taking place. Well, the Nebraska rule says that that is permissible. You did something that it's okay. You're permitted to do that in Nebraska. On the other hand, you're sitting there in your Nebraska office, and your client tells you that they're going to commit a murder, and you have more important things to do. You're a busy person, so you don't bother doing anything about it. And your client goes and murders the person. Well, that's okay, Nebraska. You have the choice in Nebraska on whether you want to do that. You are not obligated under this rule anyway to do anything about it. So you're not in any ethical problems whatsoever if your client murders somebody. Well, here in Minnesota, you tell us that we're just morally outraged that we just think all these shysters in Nebraska are literally letting their clients get away with murder, and that's not something we would put up with here. So therefore, in Minnesota, we have a little bit different version of the rule, because in Minnesota, in that exact same situation, the lawyer shall reveal information if we believe it's necessary to prevent the client from committing a crime or fraud that will result in death or serious bodily injury or substantial financial or property damage. So we're morally superior here, so we are obligated to call the Minneapolis police and turn in our client for murder. So we can give ourselves a pat on the back and feel good about it that we're morally superior to these Nebraska attorneys, until we stop and think about it a little bit more, because there is actually the Nebraska approach in many ways actually makes a lot more sense. And let me explain why. Because here in Minnesota, you're obligated, I've met many of these Nebraska attorneys, and I think they would probably do the right thing and probably turn their client in, try to prevent this murder from taking place. Because where it turns into a problem is because if you look at the rule, it says it has to be a crime or a fraudulent act. Well, murder is certainly a crime, but it has to be not just any petty old crime. It has to be one that will result in death or serious bodily injury or substantial financial or property damage. So let's change the hypothetical, and our client is no longer going to commit a murder. They are going to commit shoplifting. They're kleptomaniacs, either in Nebraska or Minnesota, and they reveal this to you, and they're going to go down to Walmart and do a little bit of shoplifting. But they kind of have it under control, so they only steal inexpensive items. So they're going to go steal some, candy down at the Walmart. Well, in both states, our obligation is the same. That information is confidential because we learned it during the course of a representation. So we are not permitted in Nebraska, nor are we obligated in Minnesota to turn our client in. Where it gets a little bit more problematic, and I see we're out of time here, where it gets a little bit more problematic is, well, what if our client is going to steal $1,000? Well, then it all hinges on whether or not that's a substantial amount of financial or property damage. So in Minnesota, if my client came in and I learned that they were going to steal $1,000, well, I should probably try to talk them out of it. But if I can't do that, what is my obligation? Well, my obligation hinges on whether or not $1,000 is substantial. So I decide to let my client get away with it. Well, then I get in trouble because the Supreme Court says that, $1,000, that was a substantial amount of money, so you're disbarred. On the other hand, I turn my client in, I get in trouble, and the Minnesota Supreme Court says, wow, you're disbarred for turning your client in, violating confidentiality, because $1,000, that was not substantial. So it's kind of a certain amount of uneasiness on my part about what I'm supposed to do. Whereas the Nebraska attorney, they can err on the side of caution. So I would tell the Nebraska attorney, well, in that situation, try to talk your client out of it, but err on the side of confidentiality. Whereas in Minnesota, I have to do exactly the right thing. Now, for those of you in Iowa, they kind of follow a middle ground, which I don't know if it makes any difference. Because Iowa, like Minnesota, uses the word may. It says you may reveal the information if it's a serious crime resulting in death or serious financial loss. But then it goes on to say that you shall reveal the information if the harm is imminent. Well, I don't know what the difference is. I guess the only difference is that the Iowa attorney can wait until right before the murder to call the police, whereas I maybe am obligated to call them right away. So I don't know if there's any actual difference. But you can tell the Iowa Supreme Court kind of detected that same problem and tried to change the wording of the rule just a little bit to help deal with it. So like I said, that will vary a little bit from state to state. Finally, I will give the final code number for this segment of the program, and that is E589. E589 is our last code word. At this point, I'll pause for anybody taking the program live if you have any questions. Well, hearing none, if you are taking it on the podcast, feel free to email me or give me a call with any questions, and I'll answer them in the time specified by the rule. So thank you for joining me today, and look forward to seeing you at part two or at future programs.